are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, May 11th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jimmy Dore from The Jimmy Dore Show and TYT to discuss, we'll discuss the West Virginia results, the state of the Democratic campaign, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but his Bernie or bust position, ladies and gentlemen. Also on the program today, more Sanders effect. Clinton calls for a Medicare buy-in. Trump sidelines Ben Carson just for the moment and then moves Ben Carson to coach him about his meeting with Paul Ryan. I don't know. His database error, though, is corrected, but he still created a safe space in his heart for white nationalists, supremacists. Charter schools from New York to LA cheat and drain funds from public schools. The world's CO2 levels are near the point of no return. Still. Former South Carolina police officer who shot and killed Walter Scott has been indicted by a federal grand jury with civil rights violation. Heidi Cruz, free at last. Free at last.
Even according to me, that was a little bit tasteless.
Right. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. So let me just say a couple of words about this, because I know people get tired, particularly this audience gets tired about hearing this a little bit, and I imagine we're going to do this a couple more times before the election, or perhaps over the course of the summer. I do not think, well, it's not a question of me thinking or not. The Democratic primary is not over. Bernie Sanders is statistically still viable. Beyond that, I think Bernie Sanders, the longer he stays in, the better it is for progressives, broadly speaking, and both from a policy standpoint in the short term and in the long term, in my estimation. So I don't want anybody to get the impression that we're talking about this now, because this is a way of this program saying the race is over. I don't want Bernie Sanders to get out of the race. I want him to stay in the race. And we'll talk about this Medicare buy-in as an example of why. Now, it is the case that Hillary Clinton has articulated this position in the past, but not in the context of her presidential campaign. And that matters. That matters at least in terms of creating certain benchmarks. So we'll talk more about that later in the program. But let me just also, and I don't know why I feel like I have to justify this to you, our audience. Maybe it's just justifying to part of myself. A lot of people on Twitter have asked me to talk to Jimmy Dore about this Bernie a bus thing. It is out there, and it is very difficult for, you know, to the extent that I am involved in any activism, I mean, in a meaningful way. I mean, obviously, I do, you know, some things here or there. But this program, in addition to, you know, this is an expression, this program, at least, from my perspective of why I do it, is an expression of not just my political aspirations, but also I feel I have a responsibility to sort of argue about the way things are and to provide some analysis. And there's a big part of our broader progressive community that has a perspective that I think is just wrong. So I feel compelled to address it. And so, you know, that's why we're doing it. I don't know why I feel like I have to apologize for that. But I do. And let me just
apology not accepted.
There you go. I'm also exhausted. Yesterday was a very exhausting day, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But for a guy my age, I went all the way up to the FDR Museum with a bus. And it was a coach bus, as my daughter was reminding me for the 3 weeks, for the prior, like, month and a half. Like, we're going to be taking a coach bus, which is, I guess, a really big deal when you're in fifth grade. But
it's
with
true.
30 fifth graders, and we went up to the FDR Museum, and that was up in Hyde Park, New York, and that was fun. And then I came back. I played two games of softball. Then helped the kids to bed. Then went and did Hayes at 11:30 at night. Yeah, that's right. So I get home at like 12:31, and I got to get up this morning and help the kids.
Yeah, well, I hosted the show, and then we recorded Two Dope Boys. Then I got drunk with some friends. And then
you'll recall that we did some libertarian.org commercials the other day, and I still am going to take their money. In some ways, I'm like a Cato shill now. It feels like. But to sort of to hide that fact, somebody had emailed in and said, hey, can I put an ad on for this group I'm working for? If you're going to take them from libertarianism.org, but rather than, you know, make this guy pay, I said I would mention the ad a couple of times, and here's the next time I'm going to do it. The Texas Debate Collective was created in 2009. And this is incredible when you imagine, and he is not telling me to say this, and I hope I'm not, you know, blown it for, but there's a school in Texas, a high school, that is spending, what, like $52 million on a football stadium. How effed up are our priorities in this country? That this Texas Debate Collective, it was created in 2009 to allow low-income students access the highest levels of competitive high school debate. TDC provides high-quality debate education to students from low-income schools and communities each summer through its annual summer debate camp. The camp is mostly subsidized by students from rich and middle-income communities who pay full price, allowing poorer students to attend for free. Right now, TDC needs your donations after the dorm they contract with decided to double their prices for room and board. Must have been a football game in town or something. Donations to cover this price hike can be made at tdc2016.causevox.com. We'll put a link up on the blog. If you'd like to donate year-round to support students from Texas poorest school districts, go to texasdebatecollective.org/donate. Any help is appreciated. Any donation to TDC will help support building the critical thinking skills of those that need it and will need it to employ it. People who attend public schools in Texas. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jimmy Dore. It feels like We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program. It's been too long. Jimmy Dore of The Jimmy Dore Show, of TYT, of and Jimmy, what's your website?
My website is jimmydorecomedy.com, and you spell Dore, D-O-R-E.
There you go. Thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. I just want to just say to everybody, I want to pre-apologize for this conversation.
I already apologized for this conversation. We both apologized. Let's just wrap it up now and just...
Okay.
So,
it's a great way to start off a segment.
I know. Like, folks, you're really going to want to miss this one. let's ease into it a little bit because you and I are going to have a little bit of an argument, and it's one that people really seem to be looking forward to. I have to say, I don't know that we've had this level of anticipation in a long time for a guest. But
I've been married for 10 years, and I'm used to letting people down, so this is going to be one of those.
You and I, exactly the same. I think it's been 12 years for me now, constantly upsetting, I'm not going to say who in that marriage, my wife. Let's before we get to the big bone of contention, just give me let's talk a little bit about West Virginia and more broadly speaking, the impact that you think Sanders has had in running in 2016.
Well, first of all, West Virginia, Bernie won West Virginia. He flipped the state that went for Hillary in 2008. So I think it's time for him to get out.
Exactly.
He's doing that. What I think is, it's surprising to me to see what Hillary said about the Medicare buy-in. I did not expect her to even go that far. I didn't expect it to come up. I didn't expect her to concede anything to the left. In fact, because she was being pretty dismissive, I thought she was. In fact, there was an article I read by Katie Halper. She said, Hillary won't even give me lip service anymore. And so this is really surprising to see her do this about the Medicare buy-in, you know. So that's good. So I think that's the effect he's having. I think the bigger effect is, though, Sam, it's not really about Senator Sanders in a sense. It's about that there was this group of people who felt this way, which is most Americans, I think, feel like that their political process no longer represents the voters. It only represents the donors. And so he's kind of like just tapped into that. So he's tapped into the movement that I think kind of started with Howard Dean and kind of got blossomed under Occupy Wall Street. And so here he is, right? And the problem was that we had centrist Democrats that split the natural opposition to neoliberalism, right? So when Occupy Wall Street happened, Barack Obama was president. So you had half the people out there going, well, Barack, whatever Barack Obama's doing on this, I'm going to be with him. And so he wasn't doing anything on it. In fact, he gave the okay to go crack the heads of peaceful protesters all across the country. So that's where I'm coming from. I think that there was already a movement. Senator Sanders is a person with real power. He's a senator who gave voice to it, and now there's a real awakening happening, I think, politically. The fact that Hillary did this on Medicare, I think, is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and to be fair to Clinton, I mean, she in debating, Lazio in 2000, she called for a buy-in between at age 55, a Medicare buy-in. I mean, this was a popular popular idea. I think even Bill Clinton brought it up in the late 90s. But I think the idea that she has brought this idea back in the campaign. I mean, she didn't start the campaign talking about this. I think it's definitely a function of Bernie Sanders being in the race. And it's interesting, you know, as you're talking about Sanders running on issues of sort of a process issues on some level of our electoral process being bought. When he started, I don't think that was the primary focus. I think wealth inequality was. And, I mean, you know, for a while we had Lawrence Lessig, who was attempting to challenge, to enter the race. They wouldn't let him in debate. I think they should have. But he was running because he didn't feel that Bernie Sanders was talking about that enough at that time. And in some ways, I think Lessig made Sanders bring that up more to keep Lessig out of the race. I mean, because I remember a time where I think, like, you know, the Lessig was getting some. I sort of felt like Bernie Sanders was already talking about that, but Lessig certainly didn't.
Yeah, well, Larry Lessig, along with Leek and Chafee, are going to team up to produce some static electricity for a sweater later today. So.
Exactly, but
So I think that was the problem. And it's amazing, you know, that I had a side note about Bernie Sanders, you know, his campaign style. He does everything wrong, right? He yells a lot. He ends his sentence in negatives, and he uses the wrong hand gestures, right? So Bill Clinton taught everybody the right hand gestures is that thumb move, and right. You're supposed to put your hands upside down. We all know that from the TED Talk. But he does it. He does the opposite. He does it over. He does it like an old Jewish guy calling for more lemons at a deli. I need some more lemons.
Right, exactly.
And so that's so it's just funny to see how far he's gotten with all doing all the wrong things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been incredibly impressive. What do you think his chances are of winning now? Of winning the nomination. Obviously, he's still mathematically in it. But, I mean, give us a sense of when you break it down, what does he need to do from here on out in terms of winning? And where are you on the question of whether or not you think superdelegates should follow the pledge delegates or not?
Well, you know, obviously he has a very narrow path to the nomination, right? But again, look at this is more like we've said all along, this is more about this movement and these ideas taking hold than it is about a single person. I think Bernie would say the same thing, you know, right. and the fact that now people are talking about income inequality, people have realized how bought and, I mean, even me, right? This election cycle has really made my jaw drop several times, right? About, I mean, I knew that we needed to get money out of politics, but I didn't have any idea how corrupt stuff was. I mean, and Bernie really has helped, I think, bring this stuff to the light of people who are looking and paying attention. Now, there's a lot of people who aren't looking, who aren't paying attention, and, you know, I call those Hillary voters. So to me, it's like somebody made the point. He said that, you know, we're watching the People versus the O.J. Simpson trial, and they didn't care whatever the prosecution said, they were going to nullify it because of the of decades of racist cops in L.A. So they were going to jury nullify it. Somebody said that the Hillary voters are doing the same thing. They're ignoring a lot of the evidence against her because they feel they need to break that glass ceiling. They feel like this oppression of women and they want to break through it. I think that's a good theory. I hadn't heard it before. And it seems, because to me it is mind-boggling, right? It's like you're a Democrat, you consider yourself a progressive or a lefty or whatever, and you're going to vote the most anti-lefty candidate we've had in a long time. By the way, why aren't people more upset with the Democratic Party for giving us such a horribly flawed candidate? The person with the second highest negatives in America, that's the person we're going to... It's like, really, you couldn't find somebody who, A, could unite people, or B, inspire people, right? So here we are, she still doesn't have a message. She almost has the whole thing locked up. Still no message. There's no reason to vote for Hillary except I'm with her. That seems pretty weird.
Yeah, I mean, I have definitely noted that. I think that there is a lack of a programmatic message. I mean, her message is that I have a great resume, which I think she does, and that she, you know, in terms of positions, and I can get it done. It's just that the it is sort of not clear, which is a bit of a problem from my perspective. But I mean, why? Who do you think? Who should have run? I mean, like, let's transition into this. So Bernie has a very narrow path. I think it's like it requires, if everything goes right up until California, it requires him to win California by something like a 75% to 25% margin in terms of the popular vote, somewhere around there. And that's going to be, that's obviously very difficult to do. What is going on in your house? I don't want to know. So as that if that's the case, and I know you know I've listened to you on you mentioned Katie Halper's show, and I've seen you on Young Turks talk about this, but give me a sense of what you're in California, obviously. I'm in New York. At the end of the day, what how we're going to actually personally vote doesn't matter. But give me your because you know these are states which are fairly reliably blue. Give me your sense of what you of your position on this Bernie or bust, and talk about it in this sort of hypothetical sense. I mean, we know California is it's an easy question, but there are other people living in. In swing states and states that may, it's unclear, that could be in play because presumably it's going to be Trump. Give us your perspective on that.
Well, I would encourage all the people who still haven't voted in this primary to vote for Bernie Sanders. Because supporting, pledging your vote to Hillary is foolish because you're giving all your leverage away. Right. So if she knows she can count on your vote in the general, what is she what is in it for her to move? Right. If you promise to be a dutiful little Democrat and fall in line, you're not shaping the party. Establishment Democrats don't care about our little complaints about corruption. And especially if you say you're going to vote for them no matter what. So that's what I encourage all the people with the primaries left. Please go vote for Bernie Sanders, right? Because if you agree that the number one problem in our country today is money in politics, then that's the right vote.
Now, so let me just see ahead. If I understand. You're saying two different things. I mean, one is vote for Bernie in the primary, and I agree. Right. And so with that said, but are you saying that? We shouldn't say that we're going to vote for whoever the Democratic nominee is, and you know, a decent chance there's going to be Hillary Clinton at this point because that gives up our leverage.
Yeah, well, A, yes, tactically it's a mistake because it gives up our leverage, but B, I don't, you know, it was Howard Dean who said in 2003, if you want young people to vote in this country, and if you want the 50% of adults over 30 to vote in this country who don't vote, that we better stand for something because that's why they're not voting. And so I think that's Hillary's biggest, or that's the sane world's biggest fear this general election, is that a lot of people will stay home because they can't bring themselves to vote for any more of this neoliberalism, which is really just conservatism that's pro-abortion. So that's really I don't see how you could vote for this thing that the whole reason you got involved in politics anyway is to get this out. You know, we're issue voters, right? We're not person voters. We're issue. So as soon as that the candidate that represents your main issue gets out, you're going to just flip and vote the thing that you've been fighting against. That doesn't make any sense. In fact, I think it hurts my case. I'll make the case. No, I don't know. I'm not. No, Sam, I'm not as smart as you guys. I went to bad schools, and I was a C student. So you'll probably be.
Yeah,
me on
I was
debate.
A C student too, and I didn't go to great school.
Don't try to take my thing. That's my thing, Sam. I'm the dumb
C
guy.
Plus.
Okay. So I feel like Howard Dean felt back in 2003, right? So if we want to energize people, we want to get people out to vote in this country. Right now we're putting up the two most hated people in the country to vote. So I say you can't vote for Hillary. And here's my theory, right? People are afraid, well, oh my God, what if Donald Trump becomes president? My whole thing is if Donald Trump becomes president, you have all the Democrats united with the independents and purple state Republicans to oppose Donald Trump. If Hillary Clinton is president, you have half the you're going to have to fight half the Democrats, half the independents, all the Republicans, and Hillary.
So Donald Trump gets elected in November, and then who are we fighting with now? I mean, he gets elected obviously with by whom? By Republicans and presumably some Democrats, right? Independents.
I don't know if Democrats will vote for Donald Trump. I'm not saying to vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
I'm saying we can't vote for neoliberalism anymore and hope to change our system. And it's like people who don't think our system is broken enough. I mean, our system is way more broken than people understand. Here's what I found out. Here's just one little thing. We can go on for hours, but here's one little thing I found out looking into this. So this all started when Ronald Reagan scared the hell out of the Democrats back in the 80s. And in 1984, the Congress, which had been solidly Democratic since FDR, flipped to the Republicans. And it scared the hell out of them so much that they decided, meaning they, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, decided, hey, let's become like them. Let's stop losing to them. Let's get in bed with big business. Let's get in bed with Wall Street. Let's cut off some of our social programs. Let's go against our own base in the inner cities. Let's do all these things so we can win elections, right? So if you want, they created the DLC, which was called the Democratic Leadership Committee, and that thing was riddled. Just to give you an example, who was on the executive board? Two executives from the Coke Industries were right. on the board right. of the DLC. So that's what made my jaw drop. I'm like, oh my God, no wonder they deregulated Wall Street. No wonder they gutted Medicare. No wonder they built prisons instead of schools. No wonder they did NAFTA. And then they, guess what the Republicans did to thank Bill Clinton for all that? They impeached him.
Right. Well, no, wait a second. So it wasn't under Reagan. The Democrats lost the Senate, but not the House.
In 84, the House, correct me if I'm wrong, the House flipped in 84.
The House flipped in 94. The Senate, I believe, under Reagan for the midterm, the Senate flipped. I think it was in 1980. Reagan came in 82. Yeah, I think it was in 82 it actually flipped to Republicans in the Senate, but not the House. The House was, you know, that's the Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan could argue and then go have a beer together. And that's the story that we're told about that. But I think, you know, the narrative of the DLC, of the Democratic Leadership Council, is the case. I mean, it was not... Clinton was the first chair of it, but it came out of, I think, a building movement out of the Democratic Party that, you know, and I think Thomas Frank talks about this, and Lily Geismer, who we've interviewed on this program, that starting in the really, I mean, even in the late 60s, I mean, McGovern in some way disempowered unions, you know, for perhaps somewhat legitimate reasons in the context of picking who the nominee was going to be. The Democratic Party, as early as like the early 70s, started to change their focus of who they were going to look for electoral support from basically the blue-collar workers to more professional class and people living in the suburbs. And certainly the DLC was the big attempt to reach out for corporate money. And, you know, I remember where I was when Bill Clinton got elected. You know, I was at that time a comedian in Cobb's in San Francisco, looking around going like, well, I don't understand why people are that excited about this. So to that extent, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. But what I think Bernie Sanders' success has shown, and I think you're mentioning this as well, is that there is a coalition. We're seeing, you know, for a long time it was like, you know, they would refer to that sort of a professional class as sort of the wine track, right? That was the big complaint about Obama at the time. Like, he only had the wine track. And then at one point in 2008, he garnered the African American and the Latino vote, and that coalition was what carried him over Clinton. Bernie Sanders is showing that, and he's failed to get really the minority vote, the Latino vote, in the numbers that he's needed for a myriad of reasons. But he's shown that you don't necessarily need that wine track, that there is now a set of policies that appeal to blue collar and to laborers, and that I think is a movement that has occurred under a president who you and I would at least broadly agree did not hold a bank. Well, I think we would specifically agree, did not hold banks accountable at all. In fact, I think a lot of the steam that Bernie Sanders has is a function of Barack Obama not doing anything about it. And I think broadly speaking, Barack Obama has a lot of those neoliberal policies. I mean, right, the Affordable Care Act is let's let the marketplace solve this. Maybe he would have gone further if he had a Democratic Senate and House that was willing to go further. You know, if Joe Lieberman had allowed for a Medicare buy-in, maybe it would have happened. Maybe not. It's hard to know. But it seems to
Can
me.
Can I make one quick point about that, Sam?
Yeah.
Can I make one quick point about that? So I have a theory, you know, I 70% believe my own theory here on this one, but I think it's worth saying because you don't hear it anywhere else, that so Barack Obama gets – the big rub on Barack Obama is that he starts his negotiation from the middle of the other side's position, right? Instead of starting out with introducing lefty health care legislation, he proposed Romney care. So the joke I do is, like, it's important to vote because last election was Mitt Romney against Barack Obama, and if Mitt Romney would have won, we would have got Romney care, but Barack Obama won, so we got Romney care. You see how important it is?
Mm-hmm.
And so my point is we would have got what we have right now anyway if Barack Obama never got elected, because we still had a health care crisis in America, and the right wing's answer to that crisis was Romney care. It was developed by the Heritage Foundation. And so they would have proposed that at some point, and then we would have got that. So even without Barack Obama as president, I think there's a very good chance we would still have the health care system we have right now. We don't have
now,
a public option attached
now,
to
Jimmy,
that.
Wait a second. Let me take issue with that.
So let me just make one last. So if he would have proposed Medicare for all, and then they would have proposed Romney care, and then we could have met in the middle. Maybe we would have had a public option. Maybe we would have had a Medicare buy-in for 50 people. So we would have compromised instead of here's their ideas. Let's go ahead and put in their ideas. So that's all I'm saying is there should have been some compromise, but there wasn't.
Well, I mean, look, I think the point of Obama perhaps starting, you know, at on their 45-yard line or our, you know, his own 45-yard line is well taken. But I don't think that there is first off, I mean, Romney ran in 2012, right? This is after Obamacare
Correct.
Passed. But and Romney ran disavowing his own plan and had to do that to get the nomination, because the bottom line is there's no way in a million years the Republican Party was going to institute that, not in 2000, in 2008. Now, maybe back in 1993, they may have. I mean, they certainly offered it in response to, you know, what was then Hillary Care. And you could argue maybe that, but we're talking about a very different Republican Party now, and I don't think there's any room for any of that. And I don't think that would have happened in a million years. And I have a lot of problems with Obamacare, and I think it remains to be seen what ultimately it's going to be its legacy. We do know that it expanded Medicaid. And would have done so for, you know, literally millions more were it not for a Supreme Court. So your theory, let's get back to this theory about what's going to happen. So Trump gets elected, and then all of a sudden the people who voted for him are against him. How does this work? Like, walk me through this as to what's supposed to be the outcome here and how it actually works mechanically. Because I'm definitely open. Look, if somebody could say to me that, I should also say, you know, at one point we got to talk about the Supreme Court because I don't know. Well, let's just talk about your theory first before we get to the Supreme Court. So Trump gets elected, and then you think Democrats, some Republicans, and independents are going to be against him.
Yeah, that's my that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, I think purple
at what
states,
point
they,
does that they, happen? So they vote for him in, and then they all turn against him.
No, I'm talking about politicians, and I'm talking about the natural coalitions, the natural opposition to his kind of policies or to conservatism in general, right? So we could we have a united front against it instead of having a split front against it.
Like we did during Bush.
The Democrat, what I'm saying is the Democrats, that's the problem. You know, when there's a million people in the street going against the Iraq war, protesting the Iraq war, we have Hillary Clinton in the Senate with a lot of Democrats arguing for it. So that's the problem. So I think that's what Bernie Sanders is doing, is showing that, hey, you don't, you could be, you mentioned it before, Sam, you can be a politician of the people. You don't have to do the wine set. You can actually speak right to the people. They'll support you. You don't need their money, the 1% crowd. You'll get, he's getting more money right now than Hillary. So he's proving that they're chumps for going out there and taking their money like that and then doing their bidding. He's proving that you don't have to do that, that the people are ready for real democracy, and that if you give them what they want, they'll support you. So I don't know how I got off on that. But
do you
that,
think,
so that's
but let me ask you this. Do you think that I mean, I certainly a decent, a healthy amount of those Democrats who voted for the Iraq war did so because they were, well, I mean, I don't know if that had to do with fundraising as much as it did with sort of just the political climate at the time. But don't you think that there's also a certain percentage, and I don't, you know, it's tough to put a number on it, but these Democrats actually believe these things? I mean, do you think this is just a function of campaign, or it just happens to be the fact is that these are their preferred policy choices? Because my sense is that at least a third of the Democratic Party, at least if not more, are just, they're not coerced into these positions. They have these positions.
Well, there is a conservative, you know, wing of the Democratic Party. Right now it's in power, and it's been in power since Bill Clinton. But the actual voting base, they've done research on this, it's way more liberal. In fact, right now the party is way more liberal than it was in 2000. And the moderates and conservatives have fallen down inside the Democratic Party. And right now there's way more liberals than there are moderates or conservatives.
In terms of voters, again, right.
Yeah, as far as voters. So So that, to me, that's the problem. Was there really wasn't a there's the money party, and I said before, I'm a dumb comedian, and I knew the Iraq war was a lie. You can't tell me that a senator with all his information and resources didn't know the Iraq war. We all knew the Iraq war was a lie,
right?
So that's why there was the biggest protest in the history of the world against the Iraq war. We all knew it. And you're telling me people in the Senate didn't know it? That's what's wrong with our country, that those people only represent their donors and they don't represent their voters. And that's what this is about. And you can't keep giving your vote to Hillary Clinton, because we're just going to get more of the same. And her policies are almost indistinguishable. I mean, what is she going to do? What is Donald Trump going to do that you're afraid Hillary Clinton won't do?
Well, I mean, the low-hanging fruit in terms of that question is simply on the Supreme Court, right? I mean,
right.
We have Merrick Garland is, from a progressive standpoint, I don't think he was he wasn't a terribly progressive pick, but from a perspective of things that I care about, is light years more progressive than Antonin Scalia, and light years more progressive than the two people that Donald Trump has floated at this point, and light years more than anybody from the Heritage Foundation who are said to being drawing up the list for Donald Trump would be. And so, and we're talking about so many different issues in terms of the Supreme Court. And I'm not just talking about a woman's right to choose. I mean, Trump had mentioned this yesterday. I'm not just talking about things like the Voting Rights Act. You know, without Antonin Scalia, if Antonin Scalia died 5 years ago, the Voting Rights Act would still be intact. That's massive. When you talk about, you know, the integrity of our voting system, having a functioning Voting Rights Act seems to me to be hugely important. Things like just access to the courts. There was, even tiny things. Like there was a case that was settled out of court by Dow for $835 million after Scalia died. And part of the reason why wasn't directly having to do with Scalia. It was sort of a bank shot. But it had to go into like another case of Tyson Foods that was involving a wage theft dispute. And Tyson was trying to promote this theory that you couldn't use statistical analysis to determine whether or not workers had actually been robbed of their wages, which, of course, would be ridiculous. And they wanted to apply that across an entire spectrum of cases that would hold corporations to account. And the absence of a Scalia, and it was 6-2. So, I mean, you know, one could argue that this case didn't hinge on that, although there's an argument as to whether or not Scalia would have turned a couple of people. But nevertheless, you know, you're going to have, the next president is going to appoint not just the replacement for Scalia, but probably one or two or maybe even three more Supreme Court justices over the course of 4 or 8 years. So a case like this would have been reversed. Issues that involve Friedrichs. I mean, I know you're a union supporter. If Antonin Scalia did not die when he died, if he died tomorrow, let's say, you could have seen the decimation of public sector unions over the Friedrichs case. I mean, these are huge, huge issues, and there is not a shred of evidence. There is no doubt. There is no way Hillary Clinton's going to get through a democratically controlled Senate, which will happen if she is elected. There is no way someone who is going to vote against labor in that situation is going to get confirmed in the Senate from a Democratic president. And so that in and of itself is so fundamental, and particularly when we're talking about an era with divided government. I don't know that any president's going to be able to do anything other than make those Supreme Court picks. Now, is her appointment to Treasury Secretary, to regulatory bodies, is it going to be good as Bernie Sanders? No way. Not even remotely close. But is it going to be better than Donald Trump? Absolutely. 100%. Without a doubt. Because, you know, these people, on some level, they have their own opinions, but at the end of the day, they are simply relying on power bases that exist electorally, and those electoral power bases impact the other members of their party, and so on. That's why Paul Ryan is going to go and capitulate to Donald Trump, because he has to, because the plurality of that party is pro-Trump. And so I don't see, I mean, how do you deal with that Supreme Court? Is that not an issue for you at all?
Well, it's weird that we don't have to worry about Justice Bork, right? Why don't we have to worry about Justice Bork? Because in 1987, the Democrats said, no, that's a bridge too far. We're not going to do that. Right now, the Republicans are saying no to a corporatist Supreme Court. They won't even give them a hearing. So I'm saying that the Democrats could do that right back. If there's someone that they think is beyond the pale, they could say no to that person. So that's on the Democrats.
Well,
so that's
look,
what
you
I
and
think.
I agree that we can't rely on them. I mean that's fine. I can say yes. It's Russ Feingold's fault that we have John Roberts. But so what? I mean, that doesn't help. People who lose the opportunity to vote. That doesn't help people who lose the opportunity to sue corporations and hold them liable for killing their daughter or their son. That doesn't we can say it's their fault or their fault. But the point is, we have some agency here. And so, you know, the decision that we make makes a minuscule difference, but it makes a difference. It puts a piece of straw on that camel's back. And so we can't just say, well, the Democrats could do, if we know they're not going to do that, how can you possibly empower Donald Trump to offer up two, three Supreme Court nominees? And then if he even has to do it again, there's plenty of them. They'll keep finding. The Heritage Foundation will keep putting them up there. And at one point, one of them is going to get nominated and confirmed. And the idea that it would radically, and we're talking about 20 or 30 years of law in this country. I mean, I don't understand. Okay. How do you address that?
Well, I just go back to my original point that the Democrats, they did it once with Robert Bork. They should do it again. In fact, if Hillary loses and it is a Trump presidency, again, that will galvanize the Democrats. They will find a spine again, because it's just like Elizabeth Warren is proving, it's very easy to stand up against Donald Trump and his craziness. So it will be much easier for them to stand up against Donald Trump and his craziness and his nominees than it was for them to stand up against, say, somebody like Justice Roberts. Okay, so that's what I'm saying right now. We can stop it. We can stop it in the Democrat in the Senate, and I think that there'll be an energized Democrats in the Senate. They say it might even flip because what Trump being on the ticket, that it hurts the purple state senators. So that's I say to that. So you're right about that, Sam. Like if the Supreme Court did flip, that would be horrible. I'm not arguing that. Of course, that would be horrible. And Scalia was probably the worst justice ever in our lifetime. But what I'm saying is that there's a way to stop that. So we don't have to give away the farm. So we save the Supreme Court. I think that here's my long-term theory. If Donald Trump, if Hillary Clinton is president in 2 years, the Republicans take over the Senate and the House even stronger. It gets even more radical. It even gets even worse than it is today. And then in 4 years, we have a Republican president, and then we're screwed for a decade, right?
Well, wait a second. But at that point, she has nominated at least the court swings 5-4 liberal, right? Because she's going to have at least, according to your theory, 2 years of a Democratic Senate. And assuming that Ginsburg or Breyer don't resign because they know that, at the very least, it's 5-4. And then perhaps she gets another nomination in that year or two. I mean, I don't know that there's no reason to believe at this point that there's not going to be that Democrats aren't going to lose the Senate or the House in 2 years anyways in 2018. I mean, I don't know why, you know, whether or not it's Donald Trump or not. I mean, Democrats have problems getting people out to the polls on off-year elections. Now, I think it's their fault because they're not offering something more programmatic.
So you're laying out, you're basically making my case for me right now. Hey, the Democrats, we're going to lose in the midterms no matter what happens because they're a horrible party and they keep giving us horrible corporatist candidates that everybody hates and they're just like Republicans anyway. So what's the difference? She's going to become president. She's going to flip on TPP. She's going to continue the deportations that Barack Obama's doing.
Well, wait a second. Let's talk about TPP because if we're going to break it down this way, let's break it down this way. Let me give you a scenario about TPP. Okay.
I just disagree with you. Before we get off Supreme Court, I hear your point. It's a good point. I'm not saying it's not a bad point. I'm saying I disagree with your analysis. I'm not saying it's bad analysis. I'm just saying I see another thing happening more likely, which is that the Democrats stand up against Trump and that just like they're standing up against Barack Obama when he's nominating a moderate, they can stand up against a crazy. Okay, go ahead.
Well, all right. But to be fair, okay, before Robert Bork, you got Antonin Scalia. After Robert Bork, you got Anthony Kennedy, who, you know, that Reagan passed through.
Right.
And then under George W. Bush, you had Clarence Thomas. You had Souter, which worked out nicely, but you had Clarence Thomas. I mean, so, I just don't think that there's no, and then, of course, you know, the Democrats couldn't stop Roberts or Alito, who is probably even more radically conservative than Scalia was. So, you know, you're putting your eggs in a very, very precarious basket, I would say, in that regard. But leaving that aside, which I think is, you know, it's massive. My theory about TPP is that if Hillary Clinton is the president, and I do think she would be inclined to perhaps change her mind. She's going to come in, though, with a more progressive Senate that is already oriented to not being supportive of the TPP. But I think they probably would sign off it anyways. But you also then at that point have a Congress which will probably lose 10 or 15 Republican House members. It will be a more virulently conservative caucus because those people who leave, who get thrown out, will be replaced by more sort of like moderate to conservative Democrats, but leaving more conservative Republicans there. And I think it's much harder to get those conservative Republicans to vote to provide Hillary Clinton, you know, to sign off on Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's TPP at that point. So, you know, and I don't know why you have faith in Donald Trump to actually to maintain anything. I mean, the guy is a pathological liar. He is there is no reason to believe that he wouldn't sign TPP, even though he's been speaking out against it. I mean, I don't know why you would trust Donald Trump any more than you would Hillary Clinton.
No, I don't know. I don't trust Donald. It's not. It's about, you know, I know what we're getting with Hillary Clinton. It's a gamble with Donald Trump. And by the way, we might be passing up an opportunity for the Republican Party to destroy itself, right? So we might be passing that opportunity up and just handing it back to them. A Hillary Clinton presidency sets back progressivism a decade.
But why do you say that? Did you think Barack Obama's election set back progressivism a decade?
Yes, I think it hurt it in a lot of ways, especially because of Occupy Wall Street, especially what happened in Wisconsin with the teachers. He never did put on that soft shoe.
No, I agree with you. But do you think that would have happened under a Republican president?
Yeah. Yes. What he's done. Yes. He's a corp. I mean, he's pushing TPP right now, Sam.
No, I understand that. No, no, no. I know. I'm not disputing with you that who Barack Obama was.
Okay.
I'm asking you if you think that progressivism was pushed back a decade relative to where it was under Bush. I mean,
What I'm saying is that it delays what we need to have happen. I'm not saying that it rolls back the clock. Barack
Obama
didn't turn.
How does having a conservative enhance progressivism more?
Okay, because like I say, if Donald Trump is president, it flips the House and the Senate for sure, and it'll be a revolution,
Jimmy,
in a sense.
How does that work? What races do you think the Democrats are going to win? There's going to be 2/3 more Democrats running for the Senate in 2018 than Republicans. Structurally, in that way, it's almost impossible for the Democrats to win in that situation. Why do you think that before we get to census, that Democrats are going to run away with the House and the Senate? And what if they don't? What's the plan B there?
I'm going to put that. I'm not the only one to say that. I mean, off-term elections, this for sure, I think would flip. And a lot of people have said. Now people say, well, a House is gerrymandered too much for it to flip.
Well, it didn't flip under Bush. I mean, except for until 2006.
I've heard people say, well, Bush was no Donald Trump, also, and I've heard people say that the House could even flip now with Donald Trump. That's how much he would hurt down-ticket Republicans. So, I hear everything you're saying. My scenario is that if we elect Hillary Clinton, we get a more conservative Congress, we get a Republican in the next 4 years, and then it's just horrible. We continue this horrible slide. You know, we're living in bigger income disparity right now. After 8 years of Barack Obama, we're living with bigger income disparity now than they had during the Gilded Age.
So, I agree with that.
But wait a second, let me just parse
what you're saying. If we vote for Hillary Clinton now, we're going to get a conservative president in 4 years.
Yes.
So you're saying the way we should fight that is by getting a conservative president now.
I'm not saying that we should get one. I'm not rooting for Donald Trump to win. So I'm saying that there is a positive potentially outcome of his presidency, and that people shouldn't vote for Hillary out of fear of his presidency. People should keep fighting for what they're fighting for instead of being afraid and voting their fear. So even if Donald Trump becomes president, we still get to fight for the things we believe in, and we still have control of a lot of the
what will you do about
the
what will you do about well, we don't have any control of the government. I mean, at that point, right? I mean, if Donald Trump wins, very likely it'll be with a Republican Senate and Republican House. Now, I don't think he's going to win, but why don't you get to fight with what you believe in under Clinton?
Because what I'm saying is that it's just like the Occupy Wall Street or the teachers union in Wisconsin. The president, she will split the natural opposition to those things, right? So that's why they won't happen. And we're just going to keep going farther along. I mean, I think things are fundamentally broken in America. Like, that's why we need a revolution. And so you don't think I would need a revolution, but I'm going to keep voting for the same thing I've been fighting against. So that's what I'm saying. You got to stop supporting neoliberalism because it's just conservatism that's, you know, with a few social programs that are liberal. So we got to stop the slide. It's not good.
Let me just say one quick thing.
I was doing an interview with a guy from Australia, and he was saying, I think it's ridiculous. In one breath, he said, I think it's ridiculous that America doesn't have universal health care like the rest of the world does. It's ridiculous. And then within 2 minutes, he said, but it's ridiculous that you guys would think you could have it in this climate. It's fairy dust to think that you guys could have what Bernie Sanders is proposing is going to happen. Why is that, Sam? Why is it that we can't have that same health care as the rest of the world? That we're behind Costa Rica in health outcomes in the United States. Why is that? That's how corrupt our system is, Sam, that people don't even think we can have as good a healthcare system as Costa Rica because that's how corrupt it is. We need a revolution, and voting for Hillary Clinton keeps this going. People are really hurting in America.
But
50% of all...
Enabling
Sam,
Donald Trump 50, also 50% keeps this of all, going. I mean, Jimmy, here's the answer.
50% of all wage earners earn less than $30,000.
Listen, I know this, Jimmy.
And this is
I
only
agree.
Get worse
we agree
under
on
Hillary
all
Clinton.
This. It's also going to get worse under Donald Trump. And the question is, it's like, now, Donald Trump would never, ever say Medicare buy-in of 55. He would never do that. Now, I don't know if Hillary Clinton will do it either. She won't, certainly won't happen if she doesn't have a House and a Senate that are democratically controlled. But, I mean, who is it that's going to come out in 4 years after everybody has rejected Trump, assuming that there's no 9/11 or ISIS or something like that that would lead us to another 8 years of George Bush? I mean, it took us 4 years to get to the point after George Bush to get to the point where we wouldn't have a Democrat who would cut Social Security. Right. I mean, Barack Obama wouldn't give that idea up until 2013. And it was only because the House refused to go along and refused to accept that deal. So what makes you think that voting in Donald Trump is going to get us into a better place?
You just said to me, Sam, correct me if I'm wrong. You just said, hey, we voted for Barack Obama and he was going to cut Medicare. The Republicans stopped him.
He was going to cut Social Security.
And Medicare. That was the grand bargain, right? He wanted to cut those things. And so, and it took the Republicans to stop him. So you're saying we should vote for a Democrat again because what?
No, I'm saying that after 8 years of what you're suggesting is going to happen in four, that it still took 4 or 5 years of building, of having an argument between the center and the left to get to the point where the Democrats were pulled far enough to the left where they're not going to cut Social Security. And I'm saying another 4 years or 8 years of a Republican president is going to put us back in that situation.
Progress, to me, is
moving forward. And this theory that somehow if we decide to... And look, her policies are... Broadly speaking, I mean, a Medicare buy-in is not neoliberal, almost definitionally, but nevertheless, or dropping the eligibility age, I don't know whether or not she will do that or not. But I do know that Donald Trump won't, because his party would never let him do that. And the fact of the matter is that the guy is going in with the Republican. There are certain structural implications to that, and that's just simply the reality. So the guy is going to play to his institutional strength, and Clinton is going to have to play to hers. And so there's a lot of movement, you know, with Bernie Sanders in the Senate. From my perspective, you have a reinvigorated left in the Senate. The House is still probably going to be Republican, but you also have Bernie Sanders, who's able to fundraise for a lot of candidates that are interested in those positions and maybe have been afraid in the past, thinking that they couldn't raise money. So you actually have a ballast. So the argument becomes between this centrist Hillary Clinton and a more to the left Democratic Party. I don't want to get too carried away as to where they are, but and you see the same trajectory as we saw during the Obama presidency, which is a more or less neoliberal president being pulled to the left by an increasingly a progressive voting base and as reflected in their representatives.
Well, I hope you're right, Sam. My point was that the problem was Barack Obama, right? So he was just
as opposed
like
to John McCain.
No, right? So that's
and Sarah
the whole thing.
Palin?
Like, hey, no. No, but
Sarah Palin would be running for president right now.
I'm not making that argument. That's not the argument I'm making. I'm saying that if we would have had a true Democrat instead of what we had, which is a corporatist,
that's not on the table. If Bernie Sanders doesn't win the nomination, we don't have that option. We just
I'm saying
have...
we don't get that. I'm saying we'll never get that option if we keep voting for it.
Well, I don't listen. I don't think that the general election, there is absolutely not a shred of data that you can show me that says that not voting for the Democrat in the general election ends up bringing a more progressive option in the following cycle. I mean, is there an example you can cite of that?
Because
recent history has shown me the complete opposite. We had neoliberal in office, and that's why we have Bernie Sanders now, who is contesting.
So I see your theory. Your theory is conservative presidents make the whole country more conservative, and it takes a while to unwind from that, whereas liberal presidents make the country more liberal, except we don't have liberal presidents anymore. We get
centrist
presidents or more conservative.
Centrist presidents make the country more liberal. It's all relative. I mean, look, our left isn't a real left either if you compare it to Europe. I'm just talking relatively speaking. This is what we have lived for the past 20 years. When Al Gore lost, what did we get in, 4 years later? We didn't get Howard Dean. I mean,
but we needed him then. I'm saying, but we needed him.
Yeah, but we didn't get him. We lost, Jimmy. You and I lost,
so you're saying,
and you and I
so
lost
you're,
this
you're,
time. So now we have a choice between the choices that we can't change. This is it. It's either broccoli or spinach, but we got to eat one of those, And so the question is, which one is better for us in the long run?
As Mortzall said, it's not the lesser of two evils. What we're doing, it's the evil of two lessers. And so I think at some point you have to stop supporting neoliberalism to get rid of it. And I think this is the time to do it. And I think the fear.
But you're just making assertions,
points,
Jimmy. You're not telling me how that happens. You're saying that there's going to be that Democrats suddenly in 2018 are going to take over. They're going to be more inclined to fight Donald Trump. Donald Trump's going to lose in 2020, and we're going to get a true progressive. I don't know who that's going to be necessarily, although there's,
Elizabeth Warren?
Well, Elizabeth Warren, I think, is going to be a little bit, it's going to probably have aged out at that point, to be honest with you. But maybe she runs in 2020.
Who knows? Who knows? There might be another Barack Obama type character who comes up between now and then.
Yeah.
But
maybe we end up with Cory Booker, who is, from Wall Street.
Ugh.
Or maybe it's, Julian Castro. All right, exactly. My point is that you move the ball forward by moving the ball forward.
And I say sometimes you got to take your medicine before you get better.
And what does the medicine look like? It looks
so
like
medicine,
a Supreme
so
Court
is,
that is dominated by conservatives for 30 years that has at the very least a 5-4 majority, maybe a 6-3 majority. It means probably rolling back some Medicaid for people with health insurance. It means more voter disenfranchisement. It means, God forbid, look, Hillary Clinton is pretty hawkish, too. So one never knows how things will go if there's another type of 9/11 type of situation. But if you're Muslim, you're living in a legitimate concern. If you're a minority, you're living with some measure of concern because obviously Donald Trump is providing some solace to white supremacists. So what is the pain here? And I guess tax cuts. We're going to see tax cuts for wealthy. They're already rewriting it now with. Larry Kudlow and Stephen Moore from Heritage are rewriting Donald Trump's tax plan. So what is the medicine? I mean, this is when I hear people say we got to take our medicine. I just hear, Chris Christie saying shared sacrifice for everybody.
Our medicine is that we have to confront confront a Donald Trump presidency. And I think that I'm saying that if all the things you just said were to happen, like the Supreme Court and all that stuff, I would agree with you. I would say, yeah, that's pretty dangerous. And you're right. But I don't think it will go that way because of my counter theory. So if what you said it would happen, I would be on your side. But I don't think that's going to happen. So I think the Democrats could oppose, especially if Hillary Clinton loses. That will shake up the establishment of the Democratic Party, because it still isn't. Believe me, they're still going along the same way they always have. right? So and the fact that they're afraid of independent voters in their own primary, why would you not want to attract more voters to your party at any given day of the year? Why would you say no to anybody who wants to join your party? So again, I think if Hillary loses, which we both know that probably won't happen, but if she does lose, that will finally shake them up. And that will finally go, hey, maybe we don't need to take the money of these people. Maybe people really are sick of this stuff. Hey, maybe they really are. And then the House and Senate flips in the midterms, and then we get a real progressive. That's my theory. Now, you can disagree with that theory, but I think the evidence is in. Voting for neoliberals is a disaster.
Wait a second. No, wait a second. I don't want to belabor this, but it's not a theory. What you're doing is just an assertion. I mean, you're not telling me how this works, like actual in like what the mechanism, how you get from A to you know, to D. And
if you're afraid of the Supreme Court flipping, the Democrats could stop that. And I think that they will have, it will be easy to get opposition to Donald Trump's picks for the Supreme Court. It'll be much easier for Democrats to oppose Donald Trump than it was, for instance, George Bush or Ronald Reagan or whoever.
Okay, but if the Democrats don't control the Senate, how would they stop?
You can still filibuster.
What makes you think that the Republicans, when they take control of the Senate, when they convene in January, that they, knowing that this is their big opportunity to replace Supreme Court justices, what makes you think on that first day of the Senate session that they don't get rid of the filibuster?
I mean, like, you know, anything can happen, Sam. Like, all these things could happen. But that would be bad politically for them. They would be seen on the side of Donald Trump's radicalism. I just don't, again, these are all scenarios. What if something worse happens? What has already happened is really bad, and we need to stop it. That's what I say.
Don't you think Donald Trump is also a neoliberal?
I think he is.
Okay, so you wouldn't suggest people voting for Donald Trump?
No, not at all. I'm not saying vote for Donald Trump at all.
But if a neoliberal gets into office either way, I mean...
But if he's a Republican, it hurts their party. And whereas the Democrats can regroup and become more like real Democrats, and Bernie is laying the template for how to do that. And so that's what I think. And now there's – so the future of the Republican Party – I mean of the Democratic Party is Bernie Sanders and that coalition. The history, the old Democratic Party, the past is Hillary Clinton. So the new – people under 35 and 40 are voting for Bernie Sanders. We've seen enough of this.
Do you
right?
think
we
those people are going to give up their positions just because Hillary Clinton is the president?
Say again?
Do you think those people who subscribe to his issue set are going to give up on those issues just because she's the president?
No. I think that they'll have to fight her for those same issues.
Right.
I mean,
and won't it be easier because they don't have to pull her from as far of a distance, and standing between their goal and her is not an entire political party that has complete opposite goals. In other words, can't pull Donald Trump to the left because the entire Republican Party is between you and that goal.
I hear what you're saying. You're saying that it's better to have a neoliberal because we could pull.
No, they're both neoliberals. They're both neoliberals. It's better to have a neoliberal who is relying on the Democratic Party for support than a neoliberal who is relying on the Republican Party for support, because the Republican Party is not going to fight for an expansion of Medicaid or Medicare. A Republican Party is not going to fight for an expansion. And by Republican Party, I mean elected officials and their voters are not going to fight. Neither of them are going to fight for all the goals that you and I subscribe to.
So my point is, if you vote the Democratic neoliberal in, it splits the opposition to those bad neoliberal policies, where if a Republican neoliberal gets in, it unites the opposition to those policies.
Where is the evidence that happens?
My evidence is Occupy Wall Street. My evidence is Wisconsin. That's my evidence. So when the Democratic president sides with business and corporations, it splits the opposition. Half the Democrats were against Occupy Wall Street because Barack Obama didn't support it. That's what I'm saying.
What Democrats were against Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, my God. I couldn't
even
turn on
MSNBC. Even Debbie Wasserman Schultz was, like, embracing it.
I couldn't turn on a news show without hearing somebody say, you know, the problem with the Occupy Wall Street people is they don't understand how politics work. This is Democrats. and they have to go register people to vote. They understand how politics work,
or
and that's why they're out doing Occupy Wall Street, because voting, even for a black guy with a Muslim name, gets you more neoliberalism.
I mean, to be fair, Jimmy, you can find organizers of Occupy Wall Street who are making those same criticisms in retrospect now. I mean, that's more of a process thing than their issue set. I think you know, we have evidence of what happens when we elect a Republican to the presidency. The Supreme Court goes to the right. The major institutions go to the right. Taxes and policies all shift to the right. And
how do we get liberalism back? What's your plan to get liberalism back?
It is to elect the most liberal person on the ticket at any given time. And if that means, you know, someone to the left of someone who is, you know, if it's Pat Buchanan and George Herbert Walker Bush, those are my two choices. I'd vote for George Herbert Walker Bush. If it's George Herbert Walker Bush and Jim Jeffords or, you know, Angus King, I vote for Angus King. I mean, that's what I do. And then I continue to fight and not put it all on the presidency. And I continue to put pressure in the same way that we got Barack Obama to stop putting Social Security on the table, the same way we got the Democratic caucus to vote to expand Social Security, at least in you know, as a resolution, the same way that Hillary Clinton just came out and reintroduced the idea of a Medicare buy-in at 55, the fact that she is at least paying lip service against the TPP. I could go on and on, but this is the way you do it. You get the most left person you can in office of the options you have, and then you pound them, and that's it. I mean,
we did that. Barack Obama is still a loser. He's still pushing the TPP. We still have the biggest income disparity since the Gilded Age. He still bombed 7 different Muslim countries. It's unbelievable.
But we have no ground war. We have net neutrality. We have the dream. We have DACA and DAPA, except for the fact that we don't have the Supreme Court. We have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the best new agency. We have millions of people now on Medicaid that weren't on Medicaid 3 or 4 years ago. We have people under the age of 26 who are on their parents' health insurance.
Right.
We have no pre-existing conditions. Is it perfect? By no means. Is it even remotely close to perfect? By no means. Is it better? Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
I agree with you. I made the argument earlier in this conversation that we probably would have had all those things even without a Democratic president. And that's the problem with neoliberalism. You'll never know. I mean, he pushed the freaking right-wing's answer to healthcare.
I'm sorry. If John McCain or Mitt Romney would have done those things, may God strike me down with a thunderbolt right now.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll never know. And I just think, that, you know, I guess I'll just say
well,
we...
Well, listen, if we don't elect Hillary Clinton, we may not find out that she's actually Bill Ayers. I mean, you know, I mean,
Jimmy,
I'm pretty sure she's not Bill Ayers.
Jimmy, we can go up to Vermont and start a guerrilla organization.
Can I just make one last point?
Yes.
I just don't know what people say they're afraid of Donald Trump doing, Mexicans and Muslims and wars and all this stuff. Hillary Clinton has already been an integral part of destabilizing the Middle East. She already did that. It's already been done. She was already on board to do that.
Well, she's also for comprehensive immigration reform, and she's not talking about deporting all people from Mexico. She's not talking about banning Muslims from this country. Right. I mean, you must see a distinction there, right?
According to Fusion, Barack Obama has deported more Mexicans than all the presidents combined since 1890. And that they say, according to Fusion, that Barack Obama is already doing what Donald Trump only dreams about doing. So if that's your voting. So what I'm saying again, Sam, this is what I'm saying. It's like things are worse than you think. The Democrats are more Republican than you even realize.
So, but you're saying that it's going to be better if we get a real Republican.
I'm saying yes. I'm saying because they don't split the opposition, the natural opposition to their neoliberalism. And I'm saying we have to do that. We have to stop.
But why didn't that work after 8 years of Bush?
I don't. What do you mean? We thought we elected Bernie Sanders after 8 years. That's what George Bush did.
No, we did not.
So George Bush said, "Wait a minute, Sam. Wait a minute.
Well, wait a second. You weren't paying attention. I thought we were just avoiding Hillary Clinton after 8 years of Bush. I mean, the fact of the matter is that all we got after 8 years of Bush was Barack Obama. Now, I happen to. I mean, I think there's been more good that has come out of that than bad. But I mean, look, we had the option to vote John Edwards. John Edwards was talking that. And the Democrats rejected him. According to your theory, after 8 years of Donald Trump, we should be able to get Bernie Sanders. We couldn't even get John Edwards. I mean, good thing we didn't. I mean, but the point being is that your theory of how people react to living under a conservative presidency for 4 years or 8 years is just not borne out by the truth. I mean, got Bill Clinton after 12 years of that. We got Bill Clinton after 12 years of it.
You're right. So with people, after 8 years of George Bush, people were so ready for a change. They thought they were voting for Bernie Sanders. They thought they were voting for FDR, but they were voting for a neoliberal in FDR's clothing. That's what they elected a black guy with a Muslim name, for God's sake. They were ready for a revolution.
Do you think that people would elect Hillary Clinton? Do you think the Democratic Party has the same illusions about Hillary Clinton as you think they did about Barack Obama?
No, but let's remember Barack Obama beat her by running to her left. So people did think they were voting for the lefty, and they didn't get it. Again, they got Hillary Clinton anyway. So that's the sad thing, and I'm saying we got to, at some point, Sam, we have to stop doing that so we can bring back progressivism and real liberalism to our politics. We have to break the money stream, and we're not going to do it with Hillary Clinton. It's going to get worse. It's going to make it harder. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, it will be harder for the revolution that needs to take place. Either you believe a revolution needs to take place or you don't. I think one does, because money in politics has completely corrupted our system, and that's what's wrong. That's why 50%
tell me,
less than $30,000.
I don't want to hold you too much longer, but tell me when you say a revolution, what does that mean? Like, what literally will happen? You don't own the Supreme Court anymore, right? Okay, so we have Donald Trump. The Supreme Court, at the very least, is 5-4 conservative. The people who brought you Citizens United locked in, except for now, instead of the fifth vote being dead or in his 80s, that guy is now in his 40s or 50s. If Donald Trump gets one more, it would be 6-3. Tell me what the revolution looks like, assuming everything goes according to your plan. Democrats come in 2018. Donald Trump loses spectacular fashion. We get President, I don't know, President Bernie Sanders in 2020. What happens? The Supreme Court says that campaign finance, even as weak as McCain-Feingold, is unconstitutional. What happens? What's the revolution look like?
So we get a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics, and it's been being led by the guy who just won the election. The majority. I mean, I think that's a real doable thing.
What is the process in which that constitutional amendment happens?
So I'm not a constitutional scholar, but there's two ways to have it happen. It has to happen. It can happen within in Washington, D.C., or it can happen in the states, which is what Wolfpack is doing, the Cenk Uygur's organization. Right. So they're going. So you either get the states to call for a constitutional convention around a certain issue, right? Or you get it to do it in Washington, D.C., and I think you need something like 3/5. I don't know what it is. I'm not. But you can do it in Congress, but if Congress won't do it, you do it in the states, which is what the strategy is right now. So I think you start moving the ball
states
forward,
dominated by Republican legislatures and governors.
And in fact, they're actually working. They've actually gotten Republican legislators on board.
On board so with the idea of a constitutional convention. But what they're going to bring up there, we don't know.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a constitutional convention for just one specific amendment. There's a constitutional convention, and we can bring up whatever amendments we want.
Okay, so I'm going to adopt your theory, is that you move forward by moving forward. So we move forward with getting money out of politics by electing people who are for getting money out of politics.
Even though the Supreme Court is the law of the land.
You know, you got that Supreme Court. That is such a little poker in my eye.
Well, believe me, it's a poker. It's not just a poker in your eye. It's a poker in the eyes of all those people who can't vote this year because getting rid of preclearance. It's a poker in the eye of all those families of the Dreamers who are still getting deported because it stopped. It's a poker in the eye of those people who wanted to who want to have a redress in the courts for things ranging from you know, forced arbitration. I mean, it's a poker in the eyes of women in states who are denied access to abortion care. This thing is bigger than a poker. It's like a cannon to the face. And gun laws, you know, I mean, that's just a function. It was George Bush's Supreme Court that made it impossible for us to really regulate gun laws. I mean, that's, you know, the thing we don't talk about as much is that that we don't have access to have sensible gun reform because of George Bush's Supreme Court. I mean, to me, that's all I need is the Supreme Court. But it gets, you know, but Jimmy,
I mean, I hear, like, again, you get the last word, buddy.
I
think you and I are in agreement on policy and ideas and that we need progressivism and that money in politics is corrosive and that what's happening. I think we agree on all that stuff. I just say we disagree on the remedy and how to fix it and how to get the government back into the hands of the people. And I say, you know, that theory of the definition of insanity is to do what you've always done and expect a different outcome. I'm going to employ that here and say if we keep voting for neoliberals and wanting a different outcome, we're not going to get it. We need to stop voting for neoliberals at all costs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jimmy, I think you're absolutely. I agree with everything you said, except for bastardizing that and misinterpreting that quote.
I would like to end by apologizing for that. I started the conversation.
Yeah, I want to apologize as well. Jimmy, really appreciate your coming on, and I'm a big fan of your work, and obviously people can check you out at Jimmy Dore Comedy and. On TYT. Thank you so much.
Right back at you. A big fan of both of you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. I went a little longer than I thought.
Yeah, a little bit.
But it was getting into it.
You didn't know that. I actually thought that was valuable. I think that's as smart as that debate's going to get.
I think so, too.
Maybe we could just, next time we got to do that again. We just play that each time. Anytime anybody calls.
Yeah, somebody calls on you. Hold on. Hold on for one second.
Let's cue this thing
Matt,
up.
Can you get it to the archives? All right. Yeah, here you go.
I'll clip it up. I'll have a special.
We just end the show.
I mean, I feel like there were times that we went over the same ground again and again. But
I could tell you as a listener that that is true.
That is true. But, you know, that's what happens. And that was like a classic barroom debate.
That was great, though.
Is my mic up? Thanks a lot, Matt. I dislike when people say that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. The definition of insanity is being disconnected from reality.
Thank you, Kelly. Well, that is what I think William James, or was it William James, is wrongly attributed. But I don't think that's the exact quote.
No, the exact quote is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result.
Right.
That's the...
Now, but
very familiar with that.
I think we're talking about different peoples at a different time. You know, one thing that always struck me is in the old Batman series, right? They would do this thing like, we're going to tie up Batman and we're going to come up with this like really overly complicated way of killing him.
James Bond as well.
Yes. And it's like, instead of like, just, okay, you're tied up and I'm going to shoot you in the head. It's like, we're going to have a laser and it's going to be tethered to a rope that is going to be, there's a looking glass and it's going to burn, the sun's going to burn the rope.
Too simple for you, Mr. Bond.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and it's
that
like,
move.
You know, and but in Batman, it was a little bit more succinct because it would happen every week, the same half hour. And because they capture Batman the second time, and I'm like, you know what? Why don't you just try and kill him just like in a more straightforward way? Like, why? Like, it's, you know, and it's just like, you can't say to yourself as the villain, like, I tried to kill him once. I'm not going to try that strategy again. No, you just try a different tactic. And I think it's a different context, a different era, and there's a different Republican Party and a different Democratic Party, both in terms of voters and in terms of electeds. And I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is you got two choices, and that's it. All right, we're going to take a quick break.
I like the France thing that I always use about you know, that election several years ago when the socialists lost in the first round and it went to the general election and it was Chirac, who's the conservative, and then it was Le Pen, who's literally a neo-fascist. Is that even like a question of who you'd vote for in that election? I mean, the socialist is out.
Le Pen.
Oh. Yeah, there you go. Well, because you need to actually, you need to take your medicine.
Bien sûr. il fait, God, I used to know how to say you got to break some eggs to make an omelet.
Did you study any other language besides French?
Si. Un poquito. All right, going to take a quick break. Headed to the fun half of the program, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, don't forget, this program is supported by you, our members. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com and joining the Majority Report for just pennies a day. We need your support to keep this program alive. Also, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your coffee. It's fantastic coffee. Fair trade. And if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you don't like Amazon, and who can blame you? But maybe if you... no, I'm not going to go down that road. You can buy stuff from jet.com at majorityreportkickback.com as well. You get 15% off your first purchase at jet.com. All right, quick break. We'll be right back with the fun half.